This time on the Plutopia podcast, we take a trip back in time. Austin, Texas has long proclaimed itself as live music capital of the world. In the early days of Austin's journey to that lofty title, a feisty show band helped establish Austin as a place of great music and great weirdness. Founders Fletcher Clark and Jack Jacobs tell the story of Balcones Fault in this interview from 1977.
Jack was living down in Austin. I was living up in Boston, getting kind of fed up with doing the banking business. And I was coming down to Austin on my way to California. And I stopped in, and Jack had been hyping me about what a nice place it was, you know. Come on down, it's a nice place. And the good music scene happened, and he was hanging out and picking a lot with the Greasy Wheels and some of the local bands that were happening down there. And he jammed a few times with this drummer and bass player and this other guy. And I came down to visit, and it became clear that my plans to go to California ought not to go through, and I just ought to stay there. So we had this jam session in the afternoon, and we worked up, it was me and Jack and a bass player and a drummer and this other fellow who, by the way, now runs Armadillo World Headquarters, Hank Aldrich, sat on the original jam session. We worked up about 20 tunes.
Yeah, and the thing that really kept him there, though, was, you know those double wide papers? Well, Fletcher came down from Boston where I started turning on when I was in college, and I always thought that pot was something that was sort of like allspice or paprika that came in a little plastic bag, and it was some kind of green powder. And I didn't really discover that it was an agricultural commodity until I moved much closer to the border.
Hey, welcome everybody to the latest episode of the Plutopia News Network. Scoop Sweeney and I, John Lipkoski, are here at the moment, but we're really not going to be having a current contemporary conversation. Rather, we're going to listen to an archival conversation that Scoop had in 1977 at the Miyako Hotel in San Francisco for the Zodiac News Service. Scoop interviewed the great Austin band Balcones Fault. Balcones Fault was a favorite band of mine, and I guess, Scoop, a favorite band of yours, is that right?
Absolutely.
And they were like a 70s band here in Austin. They played all over the place locally, but they played a lot at the Armadillo World Headquarters. They were on the first season of Austin City Limits before everybody in the world knew about Austin City Limits. And they produced one album, one and only one album, called It's All Balcones Fault. And I think you can find that album on various music streaming services.
Yes, it's definitely out there. And you could find, I believe I saw on YouTube, the Austin City Limits show they did, which is definitely worth a watch and a listen, because it's definitely different from what you would expect of an Austin band. And that's what drew me out to their show in San Francisco. Well, what drew me out was their publicist, Howard Bloom, which is a friend of mine in New York. And he had an agency that was handling the promotion of their album. And he calls me up and says, you've got to talk to these guys. You're from Texas. You understand their language. And I don't know if Howard did or not. He was a little confused by all the things that we would bring up in the conversation. You know, he's like, what's that? He's like, well, we'll tell you later. But
how many guys were there in that band? It looked like a crowd, as I recall.
I can't remember. It wasn't as large as the one that you would see at the Armadillo in one of their big extravaganzas, but it was pretty much all the guys on the album. And it was just the people we'll be talking with is Fletcher Clark, who is still with us. He is down in Lockhart, last time I heard, and did regular shows at a club down there. And Jack Jacobs, who left us all, I think, in 2006. And Fletcher was a vice president at a bank before he ended up in Austin. And Jack was a political history instructor and working on his PhD, and they ended up in Austin, and none of those careers continued after that. They just continued being whatever they became because of being part of Balcones Vault and being part of Austin.
And you know that at the time when Balcones Vault was playing, this Austin music scene was emerging. It was not, Austin is famous for its music scene now. What is it? The world's music capital, I think, is what our friend Max Knopfziger called it at one point when he was on the city council, and that kind of spread. So people do think of Austin as, if not the music capital of the world, at least a music capital of the world. But back then, that whole thing was just starting to gel. I mean, we had had in the 60s, we had the Vulcan Gas Company and several other clubs in town where there were some new and innovative bands playing. We had the real genesis of psychedelic music was here with the 13th Floor Elevators. And not too long after that, we had the founding of the Armadillo World Headquarters. And the Armadillo World Headquarters became a huge, huge popular venue that everybody had to play. And there were very few bands that toured back in the 70s that didn't play at the Armadillo.
Yeah, it became like a music fan's mecca. I know I traveled down many times because wherever I was living wasn't Austin at the time, so I had to go a little distance, but it was well worth the trip.
Yeah, and I can remember paying $2, a dollar a piece, my wife and I, to see Bruce Springsteen the first time he played Austin, when he was not particularly well known, but in Austin, people knew about him because they were playing his latest album, The Wild, The Innocent, and The E Street Shuffle in heavy rotation on KUT, the college radio station. And he had a pretty good turnout. And it was a turning point for him as well as for the Armadillo.
Well, you know, the whole thing of the Armadillo kind of came from, was inspired, I guess, by Jim Franklin, the great artist, the great posters that Jim Franklin did for the Vulcan and later for the Armadillo. And just the whole image of the Armadillo became kind of synonymous with Austin for sure, and even Texas. It's kind of, I had explained to me that the Armadillo was the Texas national bird. Which made total sense to me.
Well, you know, when tripping hippies trip over something like an armadillo, it's definitely going to find its way into their heads and into their mythologies. And that's kind of what happened there.
Yeah, the whole, in fact, I did an interview back around that time with some guy that was running the first Armadillo festival, and they had things like Prairie Frisbees, which was trying to get the effect of a frisbee with a cow patty, which sounded like an interesting event. I didn't make it to that, but he made it sound interesting. So armadillos became kind of a holy symbol for a certain weird bunch in Texas.
And I think the band that we're talking about, Balcones Vault, was just the perfect example of the kind of bands that were kind of popping up here in Austin. And that went all through the 70s. We had a bunch of different bands that appeared. And before that, I mean, going back into the 60s, I remember seeing bands called things like the Water Brothers and Ramon and the Four Daddy-O's. And who else were we talking about? The Hub City Movers.
Yeah, and the Conqueror, my buddy Wally Stouffer was with them for a while, and along with lots of good musicians. And they
And Jimmy Dale Gilmore was with the Hub City Movers.
Yep. So there was a lot of good stuff happening. But in San Francisco, when this all occurred, this show, I heard, I heard about it from our friend Jonick Petoskey wrote a great article in Texas Monthly about the band. And it got my interest. And I found out that this was a Texas show band. And it's like, that's not anything we've seen at the old Waldorf, which is Bill Graham's club in San Francisco. So I was immediately interested. Most of the bands that you were seeing were either folky holdovers or psychedelic remnants or people who are trying to be the up-and-coming glam rockers. But show bands, you didn't see a bunch of that. So that had my interest. And they kept my interest. Once they were performing, I had a good time. And the Texas Mafia was out there. And there were the Texas Mafia was a lot of ex-Texans who moved out to San Francisco for various business or professional reasons. And they always tended to gather when there was someone from the homeland coming to town. And this was one of those events that was a lot of fun. And after it was over, I have no recollection of what I did afterward. I'm told it was fun, but I wouldn't swear to that.
Yeah, I'm seeing, I can actually show this. I assume this is probably what you saw in
That's right.
Texas Monthly, yeah. And it talks here about how they played it on the full moon, for playing on those full moon concerts. And it says covers other people's hits and aspires to play Vegas someday too. I wonder if they ever played Vegas.
I don't know, but that would definitely give Vegas a wake up call for sure. But yeah, so we've got a good light on where we're going. So I think we should just go ahead and let people listen to the people who brought us this fine Texas band, Balcones Fault.
Excellent. Let's go for it.
Oh, I guess our first professional, or no, it wasn't a professional experience. We won a high school talent show when we were freshmen. And he and I continued over the last 16 years playing folk music when we were in the East in college. We also used to do a little bit of cocktail jazz and a little bit of country music and a little bit of Latin music in our folk act.
A weird folk act.
Yeah, it was a weird folk act. Both of us figured that being well-educated and all, we weren't supposed to go into entertainment, right? We were supposed to go into graduate school, something like that. I went to graduate school and got my PhD in political theory. Fletcher was a bank officer. But we always had a fantasy, I think, about playing music full time. And in our late 20s, both of us began to realize that if we didn't get out of the bank and get out of school and give it a try, we were going to be too old, and it would always be a fantasy that we hadn't really tried. So in very short order, that's how Fletcher and I got from 1961 to right now.
Jack was living down in Austin. I was living up in Boston, getting kind of fed up with doing the banking business. And I was coming down to Austin on my way to California, and I stopped in, and Jack had been hyping me about what a nice place it was, Come on down, it's a nice place. And the good music scene happened, and he was hanging out and picking a lot with the Greasy Wheels and some of the local bands that were happening down there. And he jammed a few times with this drummer and bass player and this other guy. And I came down to visit, and it became clear that my plans to go to California ought not to go through, and I just ought to stay there. So we had this jam session in the afternoon. we worked up, it was me and Jack and a bass player and a drummer and this other fellow who, by the way, now runs Armadillo World Headquarters, Hank Aldrich, mm-hmm. sat on the original jam session. We worked up about 20 tunes.
Yeah, and the thing that really kept him there, though, was, you know those double-wide papers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do I know those double-wide papers?
Well, Fletcher came down from Boston, where I started turning on when I was in college, and I always thought that pot was something that was sort of like allspice or paprika that came in a little plastic bag, and it was some kind of green powder. And I didn't really discover that it was an agricultural commodity until I moved much closer to the border.
Mm-hmm. I was just a Yankee reefers, you know, that looked like little milk straws that you got in elementary school.
Right.
So to welcome old Fletcher, I rolled about 4 or 5 different gradations of good dope, you know, and he didn't even get through the first joint, which said, "Welcome to Texas," on it. And he got about to well and was sitting there kind of passed out on the couch, and I think he... When he woke up, he decided he would stay.
When I woke up, I was out in the, country playing music with 3 or 4 other people eating mushrooms that smelled like cow shit.
That sounds like a
I wasn't going to California. I was yeah. definitely in Austin to stay. And we had
play that for all it's worth.
We had this jam session and worked about 20 or 25 tunes. And Eddie Wilson said, "Hey, why don't y'all play tonight at the cabaret at Armadillo?" We played at Armadillo that night to. Rave reception from 75 or 100 drunk people, and after the show was over, I went upstairs with Ed Wilson and Bob Hederman and Mike Tolson of Armadillo, and they offered me the questionable job of taking over Armadillo and trying to sort of make it happen financially, and at the same time they offered me a place to live too. So man, I was just completely there. We had a band, I had a job, and I had a place to live all within a matter of a couple of hours. And so for the next 9 months, Hank Aldrich actually dropped out of it, and it became me and Jack and a bass player and a drummer. Eddie Wilson gave us the name Balcony's Fault about 3 or 4 days after.
Eddie sold it to us for $5. He had a company then called $5 Names. And it was between Balcony's Fault and another good $5 special he had, which was Sleazo Demeanor. So we picked Balcony's Fault instead of Sleazo Demeanor. We've got a punk rock group in the band called Boo Ray and the Bivalves. You know about them?
I must have missed that.
Well, there was a time when a promoter, I guess it was at Armadillo. We were budgeting our own full moon show. We had, Balcony's Fault has always kind of been a scene for extraordinary things to happen because of the varied character of the repertoire. We never attracted a rock audience or a straight country audience or a straight Latin audience or a straight blues audience. If you will, we always attracted people who were looking for something kind of bizarre because...
That's the only unifying element.
Really, the only unifying element is that we've always appealed to people who have... kind of a sense of the esoteric or the bizarre or the arcane.
Mm-hmm.
As the act developed, we began to relish the idea of trying to make that stuff more accessible to everybody, and I think that's how we've done well. Boo Ray and the Bivalves were created in order to have a unified show all done by Balcony's Fault. In a situation where what we needed was an opening act. And we created not one, but two opening acts.
Mm.
And one of them was Boo Ray and the Bivalves, which is a punk rock group. Actually, it's kind of a variant on punk rock. I think it's jerk rock.
Jerk
rock. Jerk rock, yeah. It's got two letters in common with, no, only one. Well, anyway, it's certainly not puke rock. there's some thought that goes into it, and that's why I call it jerk rock. Punk rock is more purely emotive, or amotive.
Is that what it is? I'll have to write that one. Now, I'm still trying to figure it out. I read Melody Maker every week, kind of scratch my head.
Yeah, it's not intelligible, is it?
Well, Fletcher is one of the characters who occurs in both Boo Ray and the Bivalves, and their... Boo Ray and the Bivalves are the completely blown out Dionysian side of the band, and the other opening act is Fez Fuego and the Firebirds, the completely in control Apollonian side of the band. Fletcher's in both.
Doesn't that present some problems?
Not really.
No identity crisis.
No, not at all. Not at all. It's real simple for me. I've always been that way.
When Fletcher and I decided in about January 1975 that we really did want to do it, I tried to hit on a promotion, and I didn't really think that these things, that these three shows, would end up 2 years later being being called legendary and getting by. legendary bullshit. Well, there, I caught you. But anyway, yeah, they turned out to be amazing gigs, because first thing I did was wrote a press release, said, Austin is a musical mecca, and we're going to make a lot of money by letting people in free to these gigs. And I just figured, well, that's nuts. That's just completely nuts. How can you make a lot of money by letting people in free? The first two shows were no admission. But I'll tell you what happened. I went to Bob Hederman, who's now with Shoko in Dallas, but he used to run Armadillo World headquarters pretty much, and he was the fellow who allowed me and Fletcher to play maybe four or five Balcony's Fault gigs a year, and a Balcony's Fault gig meant Fletcher and I singing and playing guitar and doing the repertoire along with any one of 23 to 40 other musicians taken in combinations of 7 to 15 at a time.
You know, traffic cop to direct
that. Well, it was exciting. That's how we built excitement about the act in audiences. There were always a lot of good musicians who played with Jerry Jeff Walker, Michael Murphy, Willie Nelson, people who were in and around Austin and who went on tours and then had time off, and they paid their guys a little bit of money. And they were always looking for 25 extra bucks, and they liked to play a variety of material, and we could all be crazy. The two drummers, McGarry and Christian, who had both worked with Michael Murphy and had both worked with Stephen Fromholtz, and McGarry had also worked with Hoyt Axton, B.W. Stevenson, and Jerry Jeff Walker. As drummers, both these guys in Balcony's Fault would get to come out and sing a tune. Like Michael Christian would sing Shop Around, I remember. And I think the first tune McGarry sang with us was Leave Your Hat On, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And we recorded that eventually, and we still do it on stage, but it's come a long way. Anyway, that was the kind of appeal of it, was that you'd get to see people who you might see in other musical situations, not only doing what they specialized in, but stretching out a little bit. And we'd get the benefit of that kind of energy, and there was great spontaneity. So we were a pickup band, even in 74 in Austin, who could draw maybe 600 or 700 people whenever it would be declared that there was going to be a Balcony's Fault gig. And it was always at Armadillo World headquarters. Mm. Okay. This marked a departure. It was that Fletcher and I were going to consolidate the band in the configuration that it was, which was two horn players and a standard rhythm section. And at that time there was no keyboard player. Although I believe Riley played on those shows, didn't he?
Yeah, he did play on all those
shows. We picked him up as a side man on these three Full Moon shows. I went into Bobby and I said, you know what I'd like to do, and this was in April. I said, I'd like for you to give me, I don't know where they are on the calendar, I'd like for you to give me all three Full Moons this summer. And I want to bill it as a summer concert series. We'll start at the beginning of the summer and bill it as a summer concert series. Nobody can possibly forget when the full moon is. Mm. It'll be real good for us, and that's the only three gigs I want. He said, fine, you know, and just kind of shook his head and laughed a little bit.
You know, it's crazy old Jack.
and it was
like
a little crazy.
A gig too,
yeah, it was a little crazy. The first time we got a fellow named Michael Osborne, who you might know from Space City, he juggled. That was one of the acts. I mean, it was whatever we got a magician who did elementary schools and birthday parties to come in and set up and do his biggest shtick for us, you know, over on a side stage. We ran three stages.
Who was this guy?
Oh, just a minute. What was his name?
and Miss Judy.
And Miss Judy, the great, Scott and Miss Judy.
Miss Judy was his wife. She was a 40-year-old dumpling.
No, they're nice people.
They really are nice people.
We also had a live chicken sacrifice. Where he didn't really sacrifice
that
the chicken.
Like an Austin.
It was extremely bizarre. No, it was more Berkeley, let me tell you. What happened was this guy who was kind of a street theater person, political activist who needed $15, said he would hypnotize a chicken for the crowd.
You put a straight line on a piece of tape or a white line on a dark table, and you take a chicken and stretch it out lengthwise along the line and stroke it, what happens is the chicken's eyes will concentrate on the infinity of the line.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they get stuck there.
And they get stuck in
a metaphysical dilemma.
That a chicken is completely incapable of dealing with.
Sense-making mechanism, yeah.
Okay, now all this sounds extremely plausible, you know. So the shtick is supposed to be, and this guy tried this out in a philosophy course in ethics, you know, and to him it was very heavy because, you know.
He trotted it out for us in the afternoon before the show.
Yeah, I mean, it was a good hype. The deal was that he was going to lay out this chicken and go through this exaggerated ritual, you know, in this secular age, to ultimately sacrifice this chicken to terminate its existence, you know, on behalf of the collective spirituality.
Yeah, there were like 1,000 people in there.
Yeah, you know? and he was really into the social thing of are these people really going to cheer me on? You know, as I get ready to waste away a being
when a chicken goes, it goes a lot of blood. Yeah. Lots of blood.
So, you know, this is supposedly the whole hype. In the meantime, he has like his wife and his kid, you know, his old lady and his kid, and they're helping him with this nonsensical part of the ritual. Like, you know, they bring a melon up and set it on the chopping block right next to the chicken. He's supposed to go whack and cut the melon loose, you know, and all kinds of stuff.
Oh, the whole thing had a political overtone when he first ran it by us, too. It was Viva la Huelga, you know, and it was they were going to be poor farmers or something like that, and the bad guy was going to kill the braceros in the form of the chicken, and we said, look, man, you know, that's not entertainment. Hypnotize the chicken for the people, they'll be entertained. But don't lecture them about how they ought to feel about the strike. You want to do that, you know, you can do that somewhere else.
What was the name of the musician? The magician?
The magician was named the Great Scott. This is not his bit, though. This is a fellow named Bob. Right. Can't remember Bob's last name.
Hypnotized chicken.
In any case, it worked, didn't it?
Well, it sort of worked. You know, the deal was is that he was supposed to... Oh, sorry. The deal was that he was supposed to ultimately lead up to the point to where he would waste the chicken, you know, waiting for the crowd to stop him because, you know, somebody's going to be moral out there. Nobody's going to be moral.
Remember the punchline? You know? I can't remember the punchline.
Yeah, well, the punchline is that he wastes this melon, and then they throw a bucket full of confetti / water. You know, it was supposed to have been water, but it was really confetti into the crowd.
Ta-da! Well, anyway,
it really didn't come to the impact that it might have, you know, if it had been pulled off. But
if he'd wasted the chicken,
by this point, it was so completely weird. That, you know, it was completely unlike anything anybody ever has seen in Austin.
What was the crowd reaction?
The crowd was weirded out, man. It was real strange. It wasn't quite funny. It wasn't quite lame, but it wasn't quite successful either, you know. And it was like,
We just went right back into music. Okay, that was the first show. The second show,
Do we have the Mooney Dancers the first show?
No, they were... Oh, no. The first show, we also had dancers, and it was the Ritzettes. Mm. And they were kind of like... They were not real good, but they weren't bad. They were like better dancers than what people usually saw. There were only two of them, I think. And they did a tap dance number on 42nd Street while we were doing something on stage. See, the Ritzettes were replaced in the second show by the Mooney Dancers. And what they were proteges of a fellow named Michael Sokoloff. I don't know if you know Michael Sokoloff or not. I think his dance troupe has moved to San Francisco recently. Mm. But He's a very talented fellow from New York who is teaching at the University of Texas. And also, essentially what he was doing was mining the talent in the dance department there. And he had a troupe of about 30 that became a viable dance troupe in the sense that they could give two or three shows a year in the Paramount Theater down there and pack the place. Good modern dance. Kind of like, I don't know, at least in the the same kind of market or audience as Alvin Ailey and Twyla Tharp, that kind of dance. So we got Don Elam, the fellow who wrote that astrological chart, and the sound effects man in the band, Steve Blodgett, to compose a moon dance, which was all percussion. And Steve, who, among other things, has been a Montessori school teacher and a welder.
Sound like
he built some special percussion instruments, one thing called a moon clock for the performance. And there was about a 7-minute percussion piece, which was nicely choreographed by three of the girls who were in the Sokolov troupe, and they were our Moony dancers. And that was a really nice piece of entertainment that we had in the second show. We also had a magician who's worked out here quite a lot. His name's Harry Anderson. I don't know if you know Harry or not. But let's see, what did Harry do that night? He did a fairly elaborate trick involving, you know, burning somebody's dollar bill and having about three coincidences turn up 20 minutes later. He's a very effective magician. He's good at working his magic on a fairly large audience.
That's pretty complicated, too.
Yeah, it's hard to do, very hard to do. And Harry ended up his act by sticking a large hat pin through his forearm right in the middle of the audience. There was a spot on him. I mean, like, there, people were all around him. And he did it, and it, you know, sort of grossed the people out who were immediately around him because it was actually bleeding. And then when the trick was over, when Harry removed the hat pin from his arm, and he took the microphone and told everybody in the audience, he said, "I have not actually pierced my own skin. What you have seen is an illusion. Don't try it. You can come backstage after the show and examine my arm. You'll see it has not been harmed." Because it's so realistic. I mean, he was right in these people's faces going, like, you know, playing the violin on his forearm.
Indeed.
With this hat pin. The other thing we had in that show was a cartoon, which is a favorite of mine. I don't know if you're familiar with this guy, Robert Clampett, who did the craziest, most freaked out cartoons in the 30s, Porky Pig cartoons. He used to do a lot of the kind of swing music cartoons that had famous examples of cartoon metaphysics, like little characters reaching inside their own mouths and turning themselves inside out and stuff like that. Clampett did a cartoon called Porky and Wacky Land that it was out in a black and white and later in a color version. The color version has a kind of a Salvador Dali landscape to it. You might have seen it a few times. It's very strange. Porky Pig after the Last of the Dodos. We ran that cartoon. I rented it from a film place and ran Porky and Wacky Land. That was another piece of entertainment in the second one. And then we had the magician back again. And then in the third one, we did Live from the Moon. And for that one, Michael McGarry, our drummer and lead singer, constructed some quite a lot of sets. And we started the whole show with a 1903 film by Méliès. You've probably seen it. It's called A Trip to the Moon. You ever seen that one where a bunch of guys in morning coats and top hats carrying umbrellas? So it's one of the first films.
Yeah, I think I saw it on an international animation film.
Yeah, the way they go to the moon is in a large bullet. They're shot up there, and you get this shot of the moon with the bullet stuck in his eye, and then in the moon he pulls it out. Yeah, okay. We ran that for the audience. They got off on it real hard. A lot of them hadn't seen it, apparently. Mm. Our landscape looked a lot like the set in that film. by the time we'd done the third show, we'd caught on to the idea of pacing so that we had a stage manager whose sole job it was to get all the acts on and off stage on time. And that was, you know, mildly complicated. It was a very crowded room, and there, we were working three stages. So it was hard for this guy to get from the stage on stage right on the side of the room to the stage on stage left. But he didn't have to do that very often. And the fellow who was doing it was one of my colleagues in school, a fellow graduate student who'd done a lot of theater work. His name is Steve Hendricks. And Steve was an excellent stage manager. And he managed to marshal all the acts really nicely so that what we had was about 3.5 hours of uninterrupted entertainment. And what we were really trying for by that time was something like a new way of presenting music instead of just, hi there and thank you very much and here's another one. The other thing was that with slicker acts, big acts that I'm sure you have occasion to see, you're talking earlier about getting tired of from going to so many concerts yourself. I would say that with bigger acts, the problem is often the same. It's that they're kind of perfunctory in their treatment of the audience. It's more like they want witnesses and certainly don't care much about participants. See, well, we're real eager to please people and sensitive about whether we do or not. We're happy if we do please people and we're, you know, our feelings are hurt or we're disappointed in ourselves. We're sort of emotional, real emotionally oriented toward how we perform. And how we perform depends a lot on whether we get the audience off.
Did you ever get into situations like that where you start playing and then the crowd gets real silent?
We were always in that situation. I mean, look at the music we're doing right now. It took 2 years to get to the point where we were a really hot thing. But I think that's true with anything that's radically different. At first, people are going to say, you know, I was booking the band at the time, and I'd call a guy up, and usually it was on the strength of a recommendation from another club that I'd managed to get into. Started with Armadillo. He'd call somebody up and say, look, you ought to take these guys in. They're pretty good. That's how we got started in places, but if the individual club owner wasn't going for allowing us to come in there and develop 3, 4, 5 gigs before we'd begin to draw out the people who this bunch of people would like that we did Latin music and this bunch of people would like that we did swing music. And usually there were people who liked 2 of the forms that we did or something like that. And gradually what happened in Texas, and I would say that it'll happen out here too, is that people relate to what they like best first in the band and maybe see the other stuff as an irritation or a distraction, because we do about 4 or 5 different kinds of music even in a short set. And I realize that we lose the attention, the full attention of many people at one time or another in a set. But what we're trying to do is do what we want to do and entertain people at the same time. So I mean, you can't please everybody all the time. Especially if what you're trying to do is do what you want to do instead of please everybody. We played for 4.5 months, 5 nights a week in the split rail. You know where that is? That's just a parking lot with corrugated fiberglass walls up around it. Literally, that's what it is. It has an asphalt floor, and you play for $15 per man per night, plus whatever you can get in the way of contributions in the hat. And we were playing strictly to please the audience then, and I want to tell you there's a direct correlation in a club like that between playing Wild Side of Life and Fraulein while the hat's going around instead of playing I Left My Heart in San Francisco or Melancholy Baby.
If you broke into 42nd Street, you might lose them.
Right, somebody might steal money out of the hat. We really do like to... we've always tried to please audiences in Texas. The reason I say every time, and we'd always start as an unknown quantity. People in Dallas were particularly weirded out by not knowing what kind of band it is. Not a rock band, not a blues band, not a country, I don't know what you call it, you know. Finally, we overcame it. They just started calling it Balcony's Fault Music, or that kind of entertainment. And maybe that's not... To me, there really isn't any new combination that anybody I see has discovered for presenting music. What we're doing is something like vaudeville or burlesque. And I do think that it's got a lot of merit. We work harder than most bands that I see. We are actually looking at the audience all the time to try to see how we're doing with them. We will change directions and change emphasis if we find that the audience is more pleased by a certain kind of material than another kind of material. We play different sets in different clubs, and it's just because we're trying to get people off. I presume that's why people go out. So we try to get into the audience, get the audience into us. We're not very reverent about anything. We make fun of ourselves, and we make fun of all kinds of different favorite authority figures. And we have a good time doing it. I mean, that's the stage act for us. We started off thinking that just to stand there and play your instrument and sing your vocal was not enough, that was a boring thing. And that's why we started wandering around on stage and goofing off and doing little skits and stuff like that while we were playing. Because it was easy enough to play the tunes, you know? And then we realized that people really enjoyed that. And over the last couple of years, we've tried to discover ways of refining that. But we keep a whole lot of spontaneity in the act. Most of what we do is improvisational in that. There may be a form, but that we all know we're going to go to. We're going to go into this next little scenario after this tune. But we don't know what's going to happen in that scenario. We just... everybody gets in their character for that scenario. And that way it keeps alive for us from night to night. You know, we don't know what's going to happen. We're pretty much past the stage of everybody trying to steal the punchline. We're all comics. Everybody's a joker and everybody's sharp. And boy, if you leave a straight line lying around the stand, you know, they'll jump on it real quick. Whoever's first gets it, you know, they get the laugh. We're always trying to crack each other up. But we've stopped doing that on stage. We pretty much know who's going to take the punchline, because that allows everybody else to support the joke. And again, that's taking the emphasis off who's going to get the credit and looking to entertain the audience, to get the audience off. It doesn't matter who gets the punchline. It's making the audience feel good.
Yeah. One of the compliments that I've heard paid to you guys was that, I consider it a compliment, that your show is more like what would have happened to the Firesign Theater if they'd been really musical.
Yeah,
kind
maybe
of that
so.
Sort of approach
maybe
to
so.
The theater.
I never heard that. I appreciate that. That's a nice comment. The Full Moon shows were the first time that we tried the new kind of format, and out here we just do sets. We're not big enough to do our own productions. Bouret and the Bivalves came out the next year in the first Full Moon show. And did I talk about Bouret and Fez on tape?
A little bit, but you didn't really go into
it. Well,
the
interesting thing about Bouret and the Bivalves and Fez Fuego and the Firebirds is that although they're both made up of members of Balcony's Fault, and more than one member plays in both ensembles and the band on the same night, I'd say more than 50% of every audience who's ever seen it never figures out that those two bands are Balcony's Fault. And I don't know why. I really don't know why. Maybe it's because I'm thinking that it's sort of like, are you familiar with the theory of cognitive dissonance?
Vaguely.
Okay, well, it's just that what people's sense-making mechanisms seek for the easiest sense-making all the time, and that that they'll completely ignore a lot of contradictions or anomalies in their everyday experience. All of us will, according to the theory of cognitive dissonance, that we'll completely ignore these contradictions because we won't encounter the information right. Because if we did encounter the information right, then we would encounter the anomaly or the contradiction, and that would constitute a lot of tension. Okay, so the tension reduction mechanism causes us not to encounter it. And what I think happens is, like, a lot of times when you go to a concert, well, you probably don't go till the act that you want to see is on.
I'm such a music junkie. I'll show up before
oh, you
the
will.
First act
oh,
even
well,
gets
okay.
on.
But it seems to me that a lot of people just X out the opening acts in their conscience or consciousness. They're sitting there drinking their beer, talking to their friends, letting the music go by them or wash over them. And that seems to me that's got to be why they don't notice that Blu-ray and the bivalves are the other act. The other thing is,
they think that's the local support group.
No. The Blu-ray and the bivalves show up so seldom that they don't think they're local. Well, we always made up a big hype, you know, that Fezziwig and the Firebirds were from New York City and Blu-ray and the bivalves were from New Zealand. And that they were both bidding for a place on a world tour that was coming up for Balcony's Fault next year. That's what we told everybody the first time they played. And then when it was over, like the next time we played at Armadillo, we told the audience that the promoters of the tour bumped us off the tour and they just took Fezziwig and Buddha in the bivalves and left us behind. And to heighten the illusion, I always do go out in the audience while Buray and the bivalves and Fez are on stage, because I'm not in either one of them. So maybe it's if they see a key figure from on stage Balcony's Fault out in the audience, they just suppose, well, that can't possibly be Balcony's Fault. And they just, you know, don't think about it. But the disguises are not that effective as visually, it seems to me. So I figure people just kind of blot it out. But that couldn't possibly be Balcony's Fault. That's the opening act. How in the world could Balcony's Fault come on 15 minutes later if that's Balcony's Fault? Man, let me tell you, those guys work their butts off.
That's quite a show.
Yeah. But that was the, you know, it was the next year, and we had had three very successful full moon shows. The first two, where there was no admission, there were like maybe 800 people the first time. There were 1,200 people the second time. A lot of people turned away because the hall really only holds about 1,200, and there were easily 200 on the Armadillo staff at that time. So that means there were 1,400 people.
A small staff, actually.
Yeah. Small staff for that organization. It's now down to about 35. Very effective. In any case, the third show, we charged $1 and took 75% of the door. And I think we got $1,000. It was incredible.
Well, I got to pay your utility bills.
Oh, it was great. That was the first time we'd ever made any really good money. And the show was worth a lot. It was worth a lot more than $1 that we charged. But I really do believe that to some extent the fact that all those shows were on the night of the full moon, combined with the fact that in America, maybe in the West in general, people blow that shit off. They just, you know, they don't believe that the moon has anything to do with how they feel. Or most people don't believe that the moon has anything to do with how they feel.
Well, they should pay more attention, because it definitely does in this area.
I certainly wouldn't tell people about it, those concerts, because that, when you bring it up to the intellectual level, then you rob people of the chance that they're really going to encounter the emotional part of it. You understand what I mean? So kind of like a good teacher, I try to stay out from in between the audience and the possibility that they might actually get taken over for a few hours by the moon. Because, man, that's a trip. That's a real trip. And it happened three times that summer. And see, the Greeks used to sit around when the moon was full, and they would have a party on the full moon. They would drink something. It was a beer kind of drink called soma. And they would drink the soma and give themselves up to the moon and probably end up just going completely nuts. The thing is that anytime you get in a mass participation situation, you have a numinous experience of something beyond yourself, and you could define that as a religious experience. But I don't think that we ourselves put much content into the kind of religious experience. We're not into telling people what God to feel or how to feel it or anything like that. All we want people to do is set their chickens free, you know? I mean, and find out what the hell they are. Now, that's really a conservative kind of attitude. It's sort of like, face whatever it is inside yourself. And what we do is, we do not have a getting down kind of emotional tone to the show. We have a real happy, goofy kind of emotional tone most of the time. And, the only thing I would say about the moon is whatever else you believe in it. And, you know, it's strong enough to pull the tides and stuff like that. And when the moon is moving from waxing, growing, to waning, there's a lot of tension because it's going from one condition immediately into its polar opposite. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of tension. And you don't know what's going to happen on the full moon. Let me tell you for sure that a lot of weird things would happen on those shows. You know, there would be odd mistakes, embarrassing silences. I think the second show was the one that was most fraught with that kind of stuff. Just weird stuff, you know, breaking three guitar strings and three tunes in a row and stuff like that. Because you don't fuck with the moon. You can't use the moon that way. And we weren't telling people, now look, it's the moon that's getting you off. It was a gig.
Yeah.
And a party, and all I'm saying is that we really are kind of influenced by the moon, and all we did was what we always do when there's a big crowd, which is just cut loose. Mm-hmm. And play, you know, like, what happens in those situations, you're talking about religious experiences, that a big audience puts its energy into the performers, so that the performers get picked up and sort of have suffer under the illusion for an hour or so that they got more energy than they really have.
A little contact high of sorts.
Oh, big contact high. And then, and what happens to us is we're really into the audience, so that we'll get real, you know, 4 feet off the ground. Mm-hmm. And then when the show's over, we're back in the dressing room and everybody's dead pale for about 5 minutes. Nobody says a word. It's like a basketball team or something like that. Real, real tired when we get off stage, especially when it's been a particularly receptive audience. Mm-hmm. And the thing about religious experience is that I think that a lot of groups talk about it, there's so many different ways of believing just in our band itself that nobody dares to trot anything out. I mean, we make fun of everything. Really all I think that's necessary is, or maybe all that's possible, is that music or musical events can be the occasion for old people and young people and people who make a lot of different kinds of money and have different jobs and completely different backgrounds. You see them all at big rock concerts, and what happens there, I think they probably realize it. For a little while, however long the feeling lasts, since they're all co-attending to the same thing, they're all on the same trip, and it certainly doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And that is a religious experience, and for each person, whatever their religious buttons are, they're getting pushed in some kind of oblique or, for some people, a very acute way. All I believe is that in an age where institutions like the church, instead of helping people get by, it's kind of asking people to help it get by, it's better if people can find some real experience of something that's outside themselves. And just to be sitting for a few minutes with 1,000 other people and be all into the same thing that doesn't have any words to it, that's just a feeling, and you know, you don't have to check it out by numbers or pulses or anything. You just know, you have a feeling that everybody is doing the same thing, and you're kind of lost in that. Well, that's religion. Yeah. I got a real, real short definition. And that's maybe too general for a lot of people, but I think that's about the best you can get in the way of real numinous experience of the transcendent today. Now certainly there are disciplined ways of doing it with yoga or meditation. I don't know if drugs do it or not, actually, Scoop, but some folks say that'll happen too, you know.
That does happen.
Religious experience. Well, anyway,
I've had religious experiences on Lone Star beer.
Well, my Lord, you're in trouble. I would say that those gigs, really, the moon was working. It was working on its own. There were a lot of people there, and the occasions just kind of matched up. There's an interesting thing that happens, which is the moon goes void, of course, around 9:45 tonight, about the time we go on stage.
So everyone's on their own.
Right. Everybody's chickens are set free tonight. So we'll just see what we will see. But I think we'll have an exciting gig tonight.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.